Chapter 5, No Tax on Macs. If the law supposes that, said Mr. Bumble, the law is a ass, a idiot. That was Charles Dickens. In case anyone should suppose that the exalted acme of the lawyer's art known as constitutional law cannot possibly be so unconvincing, so inept, so silly as a quick summary of Supreme Court logic perhaps makes it sound, it might not be too bad an idea to take one of the court's ukases about the Constitution and what it really means, and give that ukase, or opinion, a thorough going over. The subject of this little experiment in vivisection will be a case known to the lawyers as Senior versus Braden. It was decided by the Supreme Court in the spring of 1935. No, Senior versus Braden was not, of course, chosen at random. It is, for a Supreme Court opinion, mercifully short. It involves the court's favorite constitutional springboard, the good old Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. It reveals the court at its most legalistic, its most vacuous, its most unsubstantial, though for that purpose any one of a thousand cases might have served equally well. Furthermore, Senior versus Braden was not a unanimous decision. It was a 6-3 decision, but the existence of a dissent in any case involving interpretation of the Constitution has been, for some time now, the rule rather than the exception. And the dissent, be it remembered, doesn't count anyway. The majority opinion is the law, the gospel, so much so that even the dissenting judges must accept it, as with Senior versus Braden. They have accepted it when the case is used as a basis of legal argument in the future. In short, Senior versus Braden is today an integral and respectable part of the law of the land, as set forth by the top craftsmen of the profession. Here then, interspersed with an almost literal translation of each paragraph into non-legal language, and with a few pertinent, or maybe impertinent, comments, is the Supreme Court's opinion in Senior versus Braden. Hang on to your hats. The Court. January 1st, 1932, Tax Listing Day, Section 5328-1. The Ohio General Code provided that all investments and other intangible property of persons residing within the state should be subject to taxation. Section 5323 so defined investment as to include incorporeal rights of a pecuniary nature from which income is or may be derived, including equitable interests in lands and rents, and royalties divided into shares evidenced by transferable certificates. Section 5638 imposed upon productive investments a tax amounting to 5 per centum of their income yield, and Section 5389 defined income yield so as to include the aggregate income paid by the trustee to the holder, etc. Now the author. Under Ohio law, anyone who lived in Ohio and owned stocks or bonds or such had to pay a tax of 5% on the income from them, even if he got the income through a trustee or keeper of the property for him. The court. Appellant owned transferable certificates showing that he was beneficiary under 7 separate declarations of trust and entitled to stated portions of rents derived from specified parcels of land, some within Ohio, some without. On account of those beneficial interests, he received $2,231.29 during 1931. The author. The man who brought this case up to the Supreme Court, and by way of introduction, through no courtesy of the court, meet Max Sr., had some pieces of paper showing he had a stake in 7 plots of land, in Ohio and elsewhere. His stake was worth over $2,000 to him in 1 year. The court. The tax officers of Hamilton County, where appellant resided, threatened to assess these beneficial interests and then to collect a tax of 5% of the income therefrom. To prevent this, he instituted suit in the Common Pleas Court. The petition asked that Section 5323 General Code be declared unconstitutional and that appellees be restrained from taking the threatened action. The trial court granted the relief as prayed. The Court of Appeals reversed, and its action was approved by the Supreme Court. The author. The local tax collectors, one of whom incidentally was named Braden, tried to get $100-odd out of Max. He, through his lawyer, naturally claimed the Constitution protected his $100-odd, took the case to court, and got licked, so far. The court. With commendable frankness, counsel admit that under the 14th Amendment, the state has no power to tax land or interests in land situated beyond its borders, nor has it power to tax land or interest in land situated within the state in any other manner than by uniform rule according to value. Consequently, they say if the property of appellant, which the appellees seek to tax in this case, is land or interest in land situated within or without the state, their action is unconstitutional and should be permanently enjoined. Okay, the author. The lawyers for the state of Ohio say, with a sort of double dare in their tone, that if the court should by any chance call this a tax on land, then they give up. They know that the court won't let Ohio tax land in, say, West Virginia, that any such attempt would be labeled a taking of property without due process of law in violation of the 14th Amendment. And, still with a double dare, they're willing to throw up the whole case and admit that Ohio can't even tax Ohio land in this way, if this is a tax on land. Notice, incidentally, that here, in a rather casually phrased reference to some of the lawyer's comments or arguments, is the only mention of the 14th Amendment in the whole opinion. The court. The validity of the tax under the federal Constitution is challenged. Accordingly, we must ascertain for ourselves upon what it is laid. Our concern is with realities, not nomenclature. Moffitt versus Kelly, 218 U.S., McHale and Company versus Massachusetts, 279 U.S., Educational Films Corporation versus Ward, Lawrence versus State Tax Commission. If the thing here sought to be subjected to taxation is really an interest in land, then by concession the proposed tax is not permissible. The suggestion that the record discloses no federal question is without merit. The author. This is a serious matter because somebody brought up the Constitution. Therefore, we, the Supreme Court, are going to have to make up our own minds whether this is a tax on land or not. As we've said at least four times before, and if you don't believe us, here's where to look it up. You can't fool us with words. We want to know what's really going on. But if we decide this is a tax on land, then we don't have to bother to make up our own minds whether the Constitution forbids it. We're perfectly willing to take the lawyer's word on that little matter. And incidentally, the idea that this might not be any business of ours at all is beneath serious consideration. The court. Three of the parcels of land lie outside Ohio, four within. They are severally conveyed to trustees. The declaration of trust relative to the Clark Randolph building site, Chicago, is typical of those in respect of land beyond Ohio. The one covering East 6th Street property, Cleveland, is typical of those where the land lies in Ohio, except Lincoln Inn Court, Cincinnati. Each parcel has been assessed for customary taxes in the name of legal owner or leasee according to local law, without deduction or diminution because of any interest claimed by appellant and others similarly situated. The author. To go back to Max Sr. and his profits, each piece of land he had a stake in was being kept and managed for all of the people who had stakes in it by another fellow. Also, each piece of land had been soaked for the regular local property taxes, regardless of the fact that a lot of people were making money out of it. The court. The trust certificates severally declare that Max Sr. has purchased and paid for and is the owner of an individual 1275th interest in a Lincoln Inn Court property, and that he is registered on the books of the trustee as the owner of 5/3250 of the equitable ownership and beneficial interest in the Clark Randolph Building, site Chicago, that he is the owner of 6/1050 of the equitable ownership and beneficial interest in the East 6th Street property, Cleveland. In each declaration, the trustee undertakes to hold and manage the property for the use and benefit of all certificate owners, to collect and distribute among them the rents, and in case of sale, to make pro rata distribution of the proceeds. While certificates and declarations vary in some details, they represent beneficial interests which, for present purposes, are not substantially unlike. Each trustee holds only one piece of land and is free from control by the beneficiaries. They are not joined with it in management. See Hecht versus Malley, 265 U.S. The authors. The legal language of the documents under which friend Max holds a stake in these plots of land all refer to him as the owner of something. He doesn't, however, own a little chunk of any of the plots in the sense that he could go and build a fence around it and sit there. He hasn't even anything to say about the way it's run. All he gets is his share of the profits when they come in. Our concern, remember, is with realities, not nomenclature. The state maintains that appellant's interest is a species of intangible personal property consisting of a bundle of equitable choses. In action, because the provisions of the agreements and declarations of trust recorded herein have indelibly and unequivocally stamped that character upon it by giving it all the qualities thereof for purposes of the management and control of the trust. At the time the trusts were created, the interest of all the beneficiaries consisted merely of a congeries of rights, and such was the interest acquired by the appellant when he became a party thereto. The rights of the beneficiary consist merely of claims against the various trustees to the pro rata distribution of income during the continuance of the trust and to the pro rata distribution of the proceeds of a sale of the trust estates upon their termination. The author says, Ohio, out to collect its tax, claims that since Max not only can't put a fence around any of the land in question, but hasn't even anything to say about the way the land is run, he doesn't own anything but a chance of getting profits, if there are any. Our concern is with realities, not nomenclature. Back to the Supreme Court. Appellant submits that ownership of the trust certificate is evidence of his interest in the land, legal title to which the trustee holds. This view is definitely accepted by the Attorney General of Ohio in written opinions, numbers 3640 and 3869, opinions 1926, page so-and-so, wherein he cites pertinent declarations by the courts of Ohio and of other states. See also 2 Cincinnati Law Review, 255. The author says, Max claims that since he is some pieces of paper and collects money on them, he must own something in the way of land, even though he admits that legally the fellows who run the land for him are supposed to own it. Some ex-attorney general of Ohio once agreed with this idea in a general way and has applied to someone else. Accordingly, we must, remember, ascertain for ourselves upon what it, the tax, was laid. Back to the Supreme Court. The theory entertained by the Supreme Court concerning the nature of appellant's interest is not entirely clear. The following excerpts are from the headnotes of its opinion, which in Ohio constitute the law of the case. The author says, even we, the Supreme Court of the United States, can't make much sense out of the legal language in which the Supreme Court of Ohio told what it thought Max Sr. owned. Try some of it yourself. Supreme Court, land trust certificates in the following trusts, the seven described above, are mere evidences of existing rights to participate in the net rentals of the real estate being administered by the respective trusts. The author says, what Max owns is nothing but the right to collect some of the profits. Not so hard, was it, after some of the U.S. Supreme Court's own language? Supreme Court says, ascribing to such certificates all possible virtue, the holder thereof is at best the owner of equitable interests in real estate divided into shares evidenced by transferable certificates. Section 5323, General Code 114, Ohio Laws, page 715, does not provide for a tax against the equitable interests in land, but does provide a tax against the income derived from such equitable interests. The author says, still the Ohio Supreme Court talking, even if we were to admit that Max does own something in the way of land, Ohio isn't out to tax whatever it is that Max owns. Ohio is taxing the income Max made out of it. Supreme Court goes on, apparently no opinion of any court definitely accepts the theory now advanced by appellees, but some writers do give it approval because of supposed consonance with general legal principles. The conflicting views are elaborated in articles by Professor Scott and Dean Stone in 17 Columbia Law Review, 1917, at page 269 and 467. Back to the author. Back to the U.S. Supreme Court now. The state's idea that all Max owns is the right to get profits has never, so far as we know, been sanctified as the law by any court anywhere, perhaps because we couldn't understand what the Ohio Supreme Court said in this very case. We admit that mere lawyers and law teachers have played with the idea, including one of our own August number, long before what he thought made any difference so far as the law was concerned. Note, too, the reference to general legal principles. McGuire versus Treffley. And this is the Supreme Court, 253 U.S. 12, much relied upon by appellees, does not support their position. There, the Massachusetts statute undertook to tax incomes, the securities, personally, from which the income arose, were held in trust at Philadelphia. Income from securities taxable directly to the trustee was not within the statute. The opinion accepted and followed the doctrine of Blackstone versus Miller and Fidelity and Columbia Trust versus Louisville. Those cases were disapproved by Farmers Loan and Trust versus Minnesota. They are not in harmony with Safe Deposit and Trust Company versus Virginia, and views now accepted here in respect of double taxation. See Baldwin versus Missouri, Beidler versus South Carolina Tax Commission, and First National Bank versus Maine. The author says, the state of Ohio has tried to throw our own words back at us by reminding us of a case in which we once said that it was perfectly all right for a state to tax a man who lived in the state on profits that came to him through someone who was keeping property for him in another state. But that case was really quite different. One of the differences was that in that case, the tax was on income. And here, by pretty definite implication, the court seems to be saying, for the only time in the whole opinion, that the Ohio tax is not a tax on Max's income. Anyway, the controlling principles of that case don't control any longer, as we've said in several cases since then. The principle that usually controls these days is that as we see anything getting taxed twice, it's probably unconstitutional. Back to the Supreme Court. In Brown versus Fletcher, we had occasion to consider the claim that a beneficial interest in a trust estate amounts to a chosen action and is not an interest in the res, subject of the trust. Through Mr. Justice Lamar, we there said, boy, the author says, to get back to the real problem, which is what does Max Sr. own anyway, somebody else once asked us to decide, as a general principle, whether a man who makes money out of property that is being kept and managed for him owns the only right to get money, or whether he sort of owns some of the property. This is what we, meaning the nine lawyers who then made up the Supreme Court, most of them now being dead, had to say. Here's the Supreme Court. If the trust estate consisted of land, it would not be claimed that a deed conveyed 7/10 interest therein was a chosen action within the meaning of Section 24 of the Judicial Code. If the funds had been invested in tangible personal property, that is, as pointed out in the Bushnell case, Bushnell versus Kennedy, nothing in Section 24 to prevent the holder, by virtue of a bill of sale, from suing for the recovery of the specific thing or damages for its wrongful caption or detention. And if the funds had been converted into cash, it was still so far property, in fact, instead of in action, that the owner, so long as the money retained its earmarks, could recover it or the property into which it can be traced from those having notice of the trust. In either case, and whatever its form, trust property was held by the trustee, not in opposition to the Sesticate Trust, so as give him a chosen action, but in possession for his benefit, in accordance with the terms of the testator's will. Whew. The author says, if a man with some land that was being held for him by somebody else should transfer part of his stake in the land to a third person, no one would be fool enough to claim that the piece of paper involved in the transfer was a chosen action. A chosen action being, roughly, a piece of paper that entitles its owners to certain rights, including usually the right to collect money from someone, in the sense that the words chose to action are used in one section of the federal statute that tells the federal courts how various kinds of lawsuits should be handled. If instead of land, it had been goods or cash that was being held, and someone had swiped the goods or the cash, then the man with a stake in them could bring a lawsuit to get the stuff back. At any rate, whoever might have been holding the property for whoever had a stake in it would, in truth, have been holding the property for whoever had a stake in it. And just try to figure out what any of this, whatever it means, has to do with Max Sr. and the tax he doesn't want to pay. Back to the court. The beneficiary here had an interest in and to the property that was more than a bare right and much more than a chosen action, for he had admitted and recognized fixed right to the present enjoyment of the estate with a right to the corpus itself when he reached the age of 55. His estate and the property thus in the possession of the trustee for his benefit, though defeasible, was alienable to the same extent as though in his own possession and passed by deed. Ham versus Van Ogden, Stringer versus Young, trustee, Ward versus Bayard, Woodward versus Woodward, the instrument by virtue of which that alienation was evidenced, whether called a deed, a bill of sale, or an assignment, was not a chosen action payable to the assignee, but an evidence of the assignee's right, title, and estate in and to property. The author says, the man who was having some property held for him in this case, namely the case that had been decided 15 to 20 years before, owned something more than a chosen action. This fellow, as a matter of fact, had the right to any profits from the property that was being held for him, and also the right to take over the property into his own hands when he reached a respectable age. He also had a perfect right to sell his rights, and apparently he had done just that. The paper that represented the sale of these rights was not a chosen action. It was proof that the man who bought the rights now had certain rights in the property in question. We'll go back to the Supreme Court. The doctrine of Brown versus Fletcher is adequately supported by courts and writers. Narragansett Mutual Fire Insurance Company versus Burnham. Bates versus Decree of Judge of Probate 131. Bogart Handbook of the Law of Trusts 430. Three Pomeroy Equity Jurisprudence 4th Edition 1928. Columbia Law Revealed 269-289. We find no reason for departing from it. Judges and others have from time to time agreed with the general principles just quoted. So do we. That's the author. The court, the challenge judgments must be reversed. Okay, the author says, therefore, Max Sr., remember him? Doesn't have to pay his tax. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States in the case of Sr. versus Brayton. In order to find out what the Supreme Court was talking about and also what it wasn't bothering to talk about in the case of Sr. versus Brayton, it is necessary to go back a little into general principles of constitutional law that presumably controlled the decision. They start in the 14th Amendment, despite the fact that the 14th Amendment played very little part in the court's opinion. And of course, they start in the Due Process Clause. The primary principle involved is to the effect that when a state tries to tax something which it has no jurisdiction to tax, that amounts to an attempt to deprive somebody of property without due process of law. Inasmuch as jurisdiction means loosely power, such a rule seems not too unreasonable. At least it seems not too unreasonable once you have swallowed the court's habit of using the 14th Amendment for other purposes than the protection of Negroes and others against unfair criminal trials. But obviously that leaves it entirely up to the Supreme Court to decide what a state has power or jurisdiction to tax and what it hasn't power or jurisdiction to tax. And in the course of deciding, the court has laid down a lot of sub-principles which give jurisdiction a special, if sometimes indefinite, meaning. The first sub-principle is that a state has no jurisdiction to tax land outside its borders, and that, regardless of what relation it has or hasn't to the 14th Amendment, seems eminently sensible and fair. It also seems eminently pointless, for New Hampshire, for instance, would have no more tried to slap a property tax on a farm in Iowa than the United States would try to tax a ranch in Argentina. There wouldn't be any way of collecting the tax, and no state would be idiotic enough to try. But starting from that fair, if pointless, principle, the court has gradually built up other principles about what a state has or hasn't jurisdiction to tax. A lot of property today, like stocks and bonds, and IOUs, and mortgages, and trust certificates, is not so solid and stationary as land. And so occasionally, different states try to tax that kind of property at the same time, and the owners of the property don't like it. The Supreme Court has obligingly enshrined in the law various complicated sub-principles telling which states have jurisdiction to tax that kind of property and which haven't. And these jurisdiction rules have been carried over with refinements and exceptions to other kinds of taxes than property taxes, especially to inheritance taxes. Where inheritance taxes are concerned, the court has laid down the principle that if two states try to tax the transfer of the same property at the death of its owner, then invariably one of the states has no jurisdiction to tax that transfer, even though the owner may have lived in one state and kept the property in another. This is what the Supreme Court was talking about in Sr. versus Brayton when it mentioned views now accepted here in respect of double taxation, and named several cases. All the cases named dealt either with inheritance taxes or else with the application of various sub-principles of the jurisdiction rule to property taxes on other kinds of property than land. The state of Ohio, not unnaturally, had assumed that all of these cases had very little to do with the problem in Senior versus Braden. The state of Ohio thought it was arguing about an income tax, since the tax it was trying to collect from Max Senior was computed by taking 5% of part of his income. And the Supreme Court had never before stretched any of its jurisdiction rules so far as to stop a state from taxing the income of someone who lived in the state. That is why the state of Ohio thought the case of McGuire versus Treffery, which allowed an income tax very much like the tax on Max Senior, was, even though older, more to the point than all the inheritance tax and property tax cases the court named. The court, however, seemed to say that the principles of McGuire versus Treffery were no longer controlling, because the inheritance tax and property tax cases decided since then had made other principles more important, even for income taxes. But as a matter of fact, the court seemed to forget what it had decided in an even more recent case called Lawrence versus State Tax Commission, although the Lawrence case was actually mentioned in the opinion in another connection. For in Lawrence versus State Tax Commission, which dealt with an income tax, the principles of McGuire versus Treffery had been followed as perfectly good law. In short, the court had held, even after laying down the principles that limited state jurisdiction to tax in the inheritance tax and property tax cases named, that it was quite all right and in no violation of the 14th Amendment for a state to tax the income of someone who lived in the state. So in order to make any sense at all out of Senior versus Braden, the Supreme Court must have been saying that the tax on Max Senior wasn't an income tax, but a property tax. And indeed, the court implied as much in its opinion and has said so definitely since. Now, as everybody knows, a property tax is universally considered to be a tax measured by the value of the property and collected every year, whether the owner makes profits out of the property or not. The tax on Max Senior was measured by his profits, and if there hadn't been any profits, there wouldn't have been any tax. But that little practical matter didn't stop the Supreme Court from calling it a property tax anyway. The court's excuse presumably was, and notice how often you have to guess what the court means just to make its decision fit its own principles of law, that the Ohio legislature, in writing the tax statute, had inadvertently labeled it a property tax, even though it was measured by income. The fact that the Ohio Supreme Court had ignored this slip and treated the tax as what, practically speaking, it was, didn't faze the U.S. Supreme Court, nor did the fact that it is strictly the business of the Ohio courts and no concern at all of any federal court to interpret the statutes of Ohio. For the U.S. Supreme Court blithely treated the tax as a property tax, meanwhile proclaiming, you may remember, our concern is with realities, not nomenclature. In constitutional law, arose by any other name, does not always smell so sweet. Even granting then with a gulp that it was a property tax that Max Senior didn't want to pay, why had Ohio no jurisdiction to collect it? For one of the cardinal sub-principles of the jurisdiction rule is that a state has jurisdiction to put a property tax on property owned by someone who lives in the state, if that property, instead of being land or goods, consists of pieces of paper, such as stocks or bonds, which give the owner certain rights. And surely what Max Sr. owned was a few pieces of paper called trust certificates that entitled him to some of the profits from 7 plots of land on which he had no right at all to go build a fence or a house. There is at least no doubt that if Max had bought, instead of trust certificates, shares of stock in a corporation that managed plots of land, just as the trustees managed the plots Max had a stake in, then the state of Ohio could have taxed those shares of stocks without the Supreme Court raising a finger to stop it. What difference? The difference, and the only difference, is in the legal wording of the pieces of paper that did give or might have given Max a right to share in the profits. If he had held shares of stock, he would have been nothing but a stockholder. But since he held trust certificates, he was, in legal language, a Sestakay trust. And being a Sestakay trust, which only means someone who trusts someone else to hold property for him, Max Sr. claimed he was, in a sense, the owner of some of the land that was being held for him. He claimed he was the owner of land despite the fact that he had no right whatsoever to build a fence on the land or to manage it, but only to collect some of the profits. If it was land that Max owned, some of that land being outside Ohio, and if the tax the state was trying to collect was a property tax, then, argued Max, Ohio has no jurisdiction to collect the tax. For by the very first sub-principle of the jurisdiction rule, a state has no jurisdiction to tax land outside its borders. And so at long last appears the question to which the Supreme Court devoted almost its entire opinion in Senior versus Braden, taking the problems and principles discussed thus far almost entirely for granted. The question was this: does Max own land? Or does he merely own the right, written on some pieces of paper, to get some of the profits from certain plots of land that are being held by somebody else? In seeking the answer to this question, the court, despite its vaunted concern for realities, paid no attention whatsoever to the practical setup of the business arrangement under which Max Sr. had collected $2,000 in 1 year. Instead, the court looked back to an old Supreme Court case of almost 20 years before in order to find a general principle. The case was Brown versus Fletcher, yet it happens that the problem presented and solved in Brown versus Fletcher had not the remotest relation to the 14th Amendment, to taxes on land, or to taxes on anything else. The problem of Brown versus Fletcher was purely a problem of the proper legal procedure in the federal courts under the federal statute governing such procedure. The statute denied the privilege of bringing suit in the federal courts to certain assignees of choses in action, or people to whom had been transferred pieces of paper entitling their owners to certain rights. The central character of Brown versus Fletcher claimed that a piece of paper that had been transferred to him was not a chosen action, and that he was privileged to sue in the federal courts. His piece of paper, incidentally, though something like Max Sr.'s trust certificates in its legal language, gave him many more rights than Max Sr. ever got from the trust certificates. The Supreme Court agreed that the paper was not a chosen action, and that its owner was entitled to bring suit in the federal courts, and that was all Brown versus Fletcher amounted to. In the course of deciding this, the Supreme Court wrote the two long and rather incomprehensible paragraphs that were quoted verbatim in the Senior versus Braden opinion. And it was on the basis of those two paragraphs, as expressing a relevant general principle, that the Supreme Court of a generation later concluded that Max Sr. did, in a sense, own land, and so could not be taxed by the state of Ohio. Thus, the reasoning of the court in Sr. versus Braden boils down to something like this. The nine judges who held our jobs almost 20 years ago in deciding a problem of federal court procedure expressed the general principle that certain pieces of paper, giving their owner certain rights, were not technically chosen action. Therefore, what Max Sr., whose trust certificates read something like those pieces of paper, really owns is land. Some of that land is outside Ohio. Ohio is trying to tax some of the profits Max Sr. made out of his stake in that land. The tax, even though it is measured by the profits so that it works like an income tax, is called a property tax in the statute. Therefore, it is a property tax. Since it is a property tax, it is a tax on what Max Sr. owns. But what Max Sr. really owns is land, some of it outside Ohio. Therefore, Ohio is trying to tax land outside Ohio. But we have a principle that no state has jurisdiction to tax land outside its own borders. We also have a principle that a state tax on something which the state has no jurisdiction to tax deprives the taxpayer of his property without due process of law, and so violates the 14th Amendment. Therefore, Ohio's attempt to collect a tax from Max Sr. is forbidden by the Constitution. Therefore, Max can keep his $100-odd. Nor, if you can hold on just a little bit longer, is that all there is to Sr. versus Braden. Although it is all that can be explained even by the circular, irrelevant abstractions of legal logic. For Max was allowed to keep every cent of the $100-odd that Ohio was trying to take from him in taxes. Yet part of the land that Max had a stake in was not outside Ohio at all. It was inside Ohio. So even if it was a property tax, and even if what Max owned was really land, why couldn't Ohio tax the land inside its own borders? What was unconstitutional about that? There isn't even a legal answer. The Supreme Court's jurisdiction principles under the 14th Amendment allow, as they would obviously have to allow, a state to tax its own land. True, the Ohio land that Max had a stake in had already been taxed once that year under a regular property tax. So considering the tax in the case as a property tax, that made two property taxes on the same land. But there is nothing in the Constitution that forbids a state to do that if it wants to. There is not even a Supreme Court principle that forbids it. The courts rule against double taxation applying only to taxation of the same thing by two states. The Ohio Constitution might well have forbidden it, but the job of saying what the Ohio Constitution forbids or doesn't forbid is in legal tradition exclusively the job of the Ohio courts. And the Supreme Court of Ohio said that, so far as it was concerned, the tax on Max Sr. was entirely constitutional. Of course, there was that double dare of the state's lawyers in the case, to the effect that if the Supreme Court was crazy enough to call the tax a tax on land, then the court might just as reasonably throw out the whole tax. Apparently, what the court did was simply to take the dare. Despite the fact that there was not so much as a shadow of even a legal excuse for throwing out that part of the tax that applied to Ohio land. Thus, not only the inaccurate interpretation of a phrase of the Constitution or the invoking of vague general principles about jurisdiction or the dependence on tax nomenclature in the face of a contradictory reality or the muddled language of a case about something entirely apart from the issue that was decided many years ago, not only any of these, but even the foolish bravado of a lawyer can serve as a foundation on which the Supreme Court may build a chunk of constitutional law. Here in miniature is the whole vast structure of sacred abracadabra that makes up the highest law of the land. And any non-lawyer with half a brain in his head, if only he could penetrate the smokescreen of legal language, would recognize the alleged logic not only of Senior versus Braden, but of almost any Supreme Court case you could name as nothing more than less than an intellectual fraud. The fraud may have been more obvious in Senior versus Braden than in most simply because the manipulation of legal lingo and logic was more inept and clumsy than usual. But even when the nine master jugglers are working at their smoothest, it requires only a trained eye to see that those weighty thoughts they seem to be tossing around are in reality no more than balloons full of hot air and easily punctured. And the worst of it is that the Supreme Court, like all courts and all lawyers, is all the time dealing with and settling practical problems. There was a very real problem in state finance involved in Senior versus Braden. By virtue of the court's decision, Ohio lost in revenue not only Max Senior's $100, but the thousands upon thousands of dollars it would otherwise have collected as taxes from other Ohioans who had been making money the same way Max had been making money. Should Ohio then look to another kind of tax to make up the lost revenue? Or should it amend the old statute, call the tax an income tax this time, and hope that the Supreme Court, 3 or 4 years later, when a case gets that far, will be impressed by the label and hold the statute now constitutional? Regardless of the right answer, the court's solemn consideration of the type of property Max Senior owned or didn't own seems scarcely pertinent to a solution of Ohio's or Max Senior's physical difficulties. Even if the court had snapped that Ohio was taxing legitimate investment too heavily and ought to cut down on its spending anyway, and that therefore the tax under dispute might not be collected, such a decision, though hardly judicial in manner, would at least have made a great deal more common sense than any discussion of choses in action and interests in land and similar irrelevant, ambiguous abstractions. Furthermore, the larger question which the court has been gaily disposing of in the name of the 14th Amendment under its general principles about state jurisdiction to tax involves an extremely practical problem, too. From the angle of the state governments, the problem is simply, now that the people and companies and property we have to collect taxes from in order to keep running are spreading themselves over a dozen or 48 states, as most of them are today, how are we supposed to keep up with them and what kind of taxes can we impose on them without either chasing them out of our reach entirely or else going so easy on them that we don't collect enough money to keep going? From the angle of the taxpayers, whether people or companies, the problem is simply, just because our business or our property spreads over a lot of states, is it fair or right that every one of those states, or most of them, should soak us with the same kind of taxes so that we have to pay tribute a dozen times for doing or owning one thing? Whether it is income taxes, property taxes, or inheritance taxes that are involved, the basic practical problem is the same. Toward the efficient solution of that problem, the Supreme Court's jurisdiction principles contribute literally nothing. A categorical statement that the 14th Amendment denies to any state but the state of domicile, what is domicile, who is she these days, The jurisdiction to impose an inheritance tax on the transfer of intangible property, when is intangible property not intangible as with Max Sr.'s trust certificates, may sound very learned, as may the rule that acquisition of a business site within a state by intangibles gives even a non-domiciliary state jurisdiction to tax. But neither the formulation nor the application of such principles and their sub-principles and the exceptions sheds even the dimmest light on the basic difficulties of the state governments and the taxpayers. The fact is that the Supreme Court has neither the power nor the ability to find for the problem in government here involved a thorough or intelligent or workable solution. Which fact does not bother the court in the highest or in the slightest degree? It just goes merrily on laying down and applying its silly little abstract rules about jurisdiction to tax, and giving each of those silly little rules as much potency and prestige as if it had been adopted by the people as an amendment to the Constitution. As in Senior versus Braden, so in all the jurisdiction to tax cases. The meat of the real problem is passed by. The law sinks its teeth into the fluff of abstract logic. As in the jurisdiction to tax cases, so in all the cases under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. As in the cases under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, so in all constitutional law. As in constitutional law, so in all the lesser branches of legal learning, so in the whole of the law. And only the solemn and mystifying mumbo-jumbo of legal language keeps the non-lawyers from catching on. For instance, the citizens who directly and indirectly voted the 14th Amendment into the Constitution to protect the rights of the Negroes just after the Civil War might be a little surprised to learn that under the law, they had forbidden the state of Ohio to collect a tax of $100 from Max Sr. Next week, we will go over Chapter 6, The Law and the Lady.